The following podcast contains explicit language.
This is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on The Grand Budapest Hotel, the new Wes Anderson film. And joining me here in the Slate New York studio is the largest panel yet assembled for a spoiler special podcast. There's three other people here with me. I'll introduce them. From my left is Chris Wade, audio and video producer at Slate and contributor to the Browbeat Culture blog. And I believe a not lover of The Grand Budapest Hotel, correct?
Yes. Well, I'm a big Wes Anderson fan from way back and did find this movie often very delightful and often very genius. I have some major, major critiques with it. So I'm getting increasingly frosty on Wes Anderson's work.
All right. Okay. Well, we brought you in part because we do want to have a sort of tag team discussion. I wouldn't say that I'm anti this movie, but it's definitely not one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies, and we'll get into why later on. Forrest Wickman is also here with us. He is a writer at Slate and editor and a contributor to the Browbeat blog as well. And Forrest, you are definitely a pro Anderson and a pro Budapest Hotel person.
Yeah, rah, rah, rah.
All right. And finally, we have David Haglund, who is a senior editor at Slate and the editor of the Browbeat blog and other august things that I can't remember right now. We're happy to have him here as well. You are also a pro.
I love this movie. I like all of Wes Anderson movies, all of his movies, and I think this one might be my favorite.
Wow, your very favorite among all his films. All right, see, it's not even in my top five, for sure. But it is a big, perplexing, ambitious movie for him to make. There's a lot there to talk about. There's a lot there to love. And maybe we should start off by giving a sense of that, you know, all the different influences that went into this movie and what Wes Anderson is sort of trying to pull off with it. First of all, it's influenced heavily by the works of Stefan Zweig, this Austrian writer from, I guess, between the two wars. When did he die? He died during World War II, correct?
Yeah, he actually committed suicide, having been exiled from his native Austria. He wrote a suicide note that has been described by his biographer as surprisingly jaunty.
Mm-hmm. That's so Andersonian.
I know. And I think he was born in maybe the 1880s. Maybe actually a little bit later than that. But yeah, he was kind of Austria between the wars, a nostalgist for Europe before it was ravaged by Hitler.
Right, and for the way of life that was disappearing, which Wes Anderson also chronicles some fictionalized version of in this movie. And we should say this is not based on any specific work by Stefan Zweig. It was more influenced by motifs from all of his work. So should we try and summarize this multi-part whirring mechanism of a story in this movie? Anybody want to start? It's set in the country of Zubrovka, we should say. Zubrovka, is that
Zubrovka.
Right?
Zubrovka. I think it's named after this bison vodka that's very good, that's Polish, and sort of hard to get in the U.S. But
well, I assume the vodka itself must be named after something. I wonder. There must
probably
be some etymology to that word.
A region or something. But yeah, I mean, yes, it's this pastiche of all sorts of different places in Central and Eastern Europe, as far as I can tell.
Right. It seems to be vaguely Prague-like, right? The city Nebelsbad that the hotel is located in. And I don't know, there's Schnitzler and Kafka and all of those currents from kind of German-Jewish culture of the first quarter of the 20th century everywhere in this movie.
Yeah, and Zweig, we should note, was himself Jewish. And I don't think that that is a major theme in the movie, although we do have these fictional Nazis. Right. But there's not Judaism is not a subject, though this movie takes on a great deal. It centers on Gustav H., played by Ray Fiennes, who is the concierge at the Grand Budapest Hotel. And he's a dandy, really. Takes great concern with his appearance and with everything in the hotel being just so. And he also has the habit of sleeping with many of the wealthy older women who frequent the hotel.
And we should say that this hotel is situated as a kind of a very fancy resort for the upper crust nobility types of Eastern Europe and kind of the European gentry. It's a winter ski resort, it seems like, mostly. Very ornate, situated in a mountain. You have to take a fanciful little stepped gondola up a hill
to get
there. Like
a funicular kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think Gustav's love for old women is also sort of emblematic of his sort of conservative, old-fashioned streak in general, like his love for the past. And we should, I think one other aspect that's inspired by Zweig is the structure of this movie, I guess, is also taken from one of Zweig's books. So we should just very briefly, though it ends up not really being a big part of the movie. This movie starts in what appears to be the contemporary time, where there's a young student who pays tribute to an author who's known only as Author, and there's a statue.
Can I just say my first of many critiques of this movie is,
sure,
like from the first 5 minutes, the like overwhelming Wes Anderson-y-ness of it is almost like hilarious. It's bordering on self-parody because it's like a long symmetrical tracking shot through an ornate of a little girl in like a pastel pea coat,
a beret
walking through this ornate cemetery to a statue that's just a bust of a man labeled author covered in keys hanging off of it. And she pulls out a tiny ornately designed little pink book that has the story in and opens up and it cuts to the chapter marker. It's like so perfectly tidily Wes Anderson. And I mean, that'll be the theme of my critique of this, is that Anderson, as he goes on, almost more than any other creator I've ever seen, continues to move more and more not to referencing the wider world, but only referencing himself in this moving towards a singularity of style that is becoming increasingly substanceless to me.
I think the question will be, and I want Forrest to finish his summary of the structure for sure, because I think that's important, but I think the question will be whether that, for him to move forward as an artist, would be to abandon that style and go to something more gritty, authentic, whatever we're opposing to the tweeness of Wes Anderson, or whether he can come around the other side of twee, as he seems to be trying to do in this movie, and really take on big historical subjects of, you know, politics and suffering.
Yeah, I would say a couple things in response to that. First of all, I think his style is very much evolving, and while many aspects still stick around, there's also, I mean, he also makes reference to all sorts of new things. He's incorporating stop motion animation more and more, which he does in this movie, and he's, you know, got these sort of very lush scores from Desplat, which he didn't have before. That said, you said it sort of borders on self-parody, and I think the movie is basically doing that deliberately. It starts, one of the like most common phrases used to criticize Wes Anderson is that his movies just feel like dollhouses where he's just playing with a bunch of dolls. And this movie starts pretty quickly with a sort of long shot of an incredibly fake looking dollhouse. And I think, and he even did a shot, as the critic Matt Zoller cites pointed out, back in Royal Tenenbaums, he just did a shot of a dollhouse, which I think is maybe just an in-joke on this. And then lastly, I think that the movie itself is kind of a tribute to all of these little frills and flourishes, which it also acknowledges are totally ridiculous, especially in the face of you know, war and Nazis and all these atrocities. And yet they're still, you know, full of joy, and they brought me tons of joy watching this movie, and I think that's enough.
Yeah, and the movie is actually a defense of that style and that aesthetic concern in the face of atrocity.
Right, in the sense that the Ralph Fiennes character is clearly a model for Wes Anderson, right? And the hotel is Wes Anderson's career. The hotel is sort of Wes Anderson's creative project. But let's get back to the temporal structure really quickly, because I think that's important for this sense of nostalgia that's built really deeply into this movie.
Yeah, so we get the statue of this author, and then it does actually sort of get broken down a little bit, because we go from there to the actual author back in the 80s or so, who...
Played by Tom Wilkinson at that point, as an older man.
Yeah, as an older man. And he starts saying that while he wrote this book, he actually, it was just somebody else's story, and so we jump back to when this same author was younger in 1968. He's played by Jude Law, and he meets... the character played by F. Murray Abraham, who we later learn is Zero, and I think it's not supposed to be totally clear at first, but Zero, jumping back to 1932, it's very Inception-like, I felt like, going down all of these levels.
Or ornately carved Russian dolls.
Yeah. And so then back in 1932, we're with Zero, this young boy who wants to be a lobby boy because he admires Gustav. And so that's where the bulk of the movie takes place.
Right. So the central relationship of the movie, after all of these various layers are tunneled through and you get back to the 1932 time frame, where the central relationship will be between the young Zero Mustafa, played by a newcomer named Tony Revolori, and Mr. Gustav, played by Ralph Fiennes. So their friendship and their kind of mentorship becomes the heart of the movie.
Yeah, and I thought their relationship was really touching. There's another important relationship, which is between Zero and Agatha, who's played by, I believe it's pronounced Saoirse Ronan?
Saoirse.
Yeah. She works at a bakery, which turns out these exquisite little pastries, which are also both thematically and even narratively important in the movie. And they meet, fall in love. And from that point on, basically everything Zero does is either to protect Gustav or to, you know, pursue this love with Agatha.
Although we should say they meet, when we say they meet and fall in love, it should be noted that we are told they meet and fall in love and only see them after all the actual parts of courtship have already taken place.
Yeah, that's yeah. That's sort of how romantic love works in Wes Anderson, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's why Moonrise Kingdom, which so many people found deeply moving, I found utterly delightful and pleasurable to watch and very funny in parts, but completely unengaging on that level. He doesn't seem interested in, you know, romantic relationships and showing how they develop. Instead, they're assumed, right, and their significance is assumed, and then they go on to play some part in the caper story that's the center of the movie.
Yeah, but let's maybe peel through the plot, because I think it's actually pretty easy to take on.
Could I, before we go to that, could I just briefly, very briefly, sort of defend that?
Yeah.
I do think the same sort of small thing that's not explored that much in depth that brings the two young lovers together in Moonrise Kingdom is, I think it's fair to assume, the same thing that brings together Zero and Agatha, which is basically, in Moonrise Kingdom, they come together through like all of these books and paintings, and the movie ends with a painting of this creation they did on the beach. And I think it's about sort of them coming together through their love, and I think it's about Wes Anderson's love with his new with, I don't know if she's new, his girlfriend, who the movie is dedicated to. This movie, I think the same way, you can see how Zero and Agatha would bond because they're both into the sort of these fine touches on things, and Zero loves the way the hotel is run, and Agatha has this talent for making these sort of very dainty but perfect
counterpoint. We do not ever see whether or not Agatha likes her job or not, and we are never even shown in what case they would actually interact in real life before it is revealed that they are engaged.
No, I think, and I do think that part of the frustration of watching one of these, especially kind of post-Rushmore Wes Anderson movies, is that he tries to pack so much in. They're so maximalist. In Royal Tenenbaums, you have something like 8 different character arcs, and it's very hard to keep track of them, especially at first, and how they all resolve themselves and why everybody's acting so insane. But then as you rewatch it, and many of these Wes Anderson movies that have come out since then, which tend to be in this pattern, it's easier to keep track, and often I discover there is kind of a surprising poignancy in how each of those characters play out. I don't know now whether this movie will be like that, and I'll find all of these things that are more emotional that I didn't notice the first time around. I will love it regardless, but that is part of the reason I'm not sure whether it's, you know, in my top 2 or 3.
Well, this is like one of those rare movies that I actually wish was longer, because I wanted that backstory. I wanted more plot. I wanted all these characters to be fleshed out.
I agree, especially at the end, which we'll get to. I think the epilogue happens way too quickly and leaves the viewer really not sure how to, you know, balance all the conflicting emotions that we have about this huge cast of characters. But let's quickly get through the caper plot. Let's just get boring for a second
and
go through the caper.
Let's turn on the pizzicato strings and be borne along in an elaborate montage through this entire movie.
Yes, and then we can get to arguing, you know, the various merits and demerits of the movie. So who wants to take it away with the caper plot? David?
So very early in the movie, a woman played by Tilda Swinton, who's called Madame D in one of the movie's many cinematic allusions, this one to O' Fools, the earrings, Madame De. So she dies, and she was a very wealthy aristocrat, and Gustave whisks himself away to the reading of her will, where it's discovered that she left him this priceless painting. And we also meet her family, who are a bunch of murderous thugs.
Right. Oh, and we learn that she was the victim of foul play at that point, right? Or do they not know?
A little later, but
yeah, not quite yet. Although there's a lot of foreboding, right? She has a servant played by Matthew Amalric who is trying to get a message to Gustave and failing. We later learn that message is that there's actually a second will in which he's given everything. But before he's able to get that message to him, he's murdered by the character played by Willem Dafoe.
And just in a background, as Dana mentioned briefly earlier, we do learn that they have a very Gustave H and Madame D have a very intimate relationship in which he supports and provides comfort and also compliments to her and just like being there for her in her solitary end years.
Yeah, and her family hates him, and also the question of his sexuality is raised here. It seems clear that he's bisexual or pansexual or something. I mean, he sleeps with these older women, but he's very effeminate, and he doesn't really dispute the charge that Adrian Brody keeps levying against him that he's gay. He says it much more crudely than that. Anyway, it turns out that Madame De was murdered, and they try to pin that murder on Gustav. So then he's, you know, fleeing not only from the family but also the law.
Right. So then a lot more cinematic history gets folded in because he gets put in a maximum security prison, which he escapes from, sort of grand illusion grand or great yeah, escape style. Totally. And
which
you know,
is also where we learn that there is some kind of a fascist element moving into the country that they are in. They're pulled. Their train is stopped by a military detail clad in gray and black with black lightning bolts on their outfits.
Right. So there are these kind of faux Nazis designed by Anderson, which we can also get to mm-hmm. what that's all about in a minute. So as this caper plot starts to unfold, it becomes the job of Gustav and Tony to recover the painting, which they've hidden, break out of jail, recover the painting, which they've hidden, eventually find the secret letter inside the painting, revealing that the entire hotel and all of Madame Day's fortune has been left to Gustav H. And what other problems are they trying to solve? Escape Willem Dafoe. I don't know what
conceal
else.
Conceal Zero's relationship with Agatha so she's not put in danger, though she eventually is, all the while being pursued by a very sillily intimidating Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, and just survive the Nazis in general.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think that counts. We can get to the end when we get to the end, but I think that counts as a plot summary. So now I just want to talk about, like, what is going on? What is Anderson trying to do here? I mean, we haven't really mentioned how all of this looks, but, you know, if anybody wants to talk about the design and the look, I mean, it's sort of predictably for Anderson, but also, you know, going down some different roads, as Forrest pointed out, including some stop-motion animation that kind of recalls Fantastic Mr. Fox, using kind of all these great game-like, dollhouse-like animation techniques, he creates this whole, you know, believable and yet fantastical and whimsical world of mid-century Europe in decline and this fascist force looming over it. But so why is he doing that? I guess I want to understand kind of, I don't know how else to put it, but sort of the moral valence of this movie so that I can understand whether it's true that Anderson is sort of pushing into new territory and trying to create something new, or is it that he's kind of trivializing the period between the world wars by turning it into an occasion for playing with a dollhouse. I'm not really making either case. I really kind of feel like I need to see the movie again. I wish I could have seen it twice before writing on it. But I tended to feel uncomfortable when moments of real life suffering or violence came into this movie, which they do more than in most Wes Anderson movies, I would say. He has movies before where an individual character has died and the death has been mourned, and I tend to find those scenes in his movies sentimentalized and uncomfortable, and that he is not comfortable with emotion. Like, I've written about that about him for years. But when it gets to be on the scale of, you know, quasi-Nazis moving into your country and, you know, kind of wiping everyone out. Or, for example, Jeff Goldblum's death. We haven't talked about mm-hmm. that, but he plays the estate lawyer for Madame Day, who is sort of horribly killed by Willem Dafoe in this scene that's comical, but also gory in a way that Wes Anderson very rarely does. And those scenes did not sit well with me. I didn't know what to do with them. It wasn't that I wanted it all, the bad stuff to go back in Pandora's box and have everything be cute. It was that I wanted him to spin out some of that darkness and suffering a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, this movie could actually be compared somewhat, I imagine, unexpectedly to Inglourious Basterds, which is also about Nazis and also, I think, really a defense of movies as movies. To me, all of that worked because I think you really do have this sense of fear and death and of destruction that Gustav is sort of trying to survive, and he's clinging to these ideals that he has of making things pretty, making things precise, you know, attending to the small details. He's trying to keep those ideals aloft in horrific circumstances. And there are many funny sequences in which he does this, like when he's in prison, he's bringing slop to all the other prisoners, and he's basically acting as the concierge once again. But Anderson, to me, seems very aware of what he's doing with those ideals and how he's representing them. So, for instance, late in the movie, there's this key line where somebody says, and one of you can remember who says that Gustav was really from, you know, his world. Mm-hmm. His world was gone. You know, his world had died before he did. And somebody else says that, well, that, you know, maybe that essentially implies that world never really existed. That he clings to these ideals that are just that. They're ideals. There was never a time in Europe or elsewhere where they actually, you know, dominated and everyone kind of enjoyed the pleasures that he's committed to. But he's still committed to them. He still thinks these are the fine things in life and we should all try to enjoy them while we can.
And I think that's one more reason that the narrative structure is really important, because what we're getting isn't necessarily, I mean, it's clearly not actual history. And it seems like what we're getting is, through all these narrations, is a story as told in a book, as remembered by somebody else who told it, looking back on his own life. So there's, you know,
there's a lot of filters of nostalgia and idealization.
Yeah, there's kind of a long game of telephone that gives us this really weird, totally fictional world.
I mean, my big problem with all that is that we exist in this world only in this, like, very stilted, like, crystalline structure of, you know, perpendicular tracking shots and 90-degree whip pans that make everything, like, so perfectly crisp. But at the center of it, all we get are indications of, like, character archetypes to serve this story that I found lacking in any kind of detail or perspective. It's all from the outside. There's no interior, like, motivations. These people just are because they're painted that way. And, you know, it's not that I disagree, or not that I feel that every movie needs to, like, feel like it's springing organically from within itself. I mean, I love some pretty ridiculous stuff, but the problem is coming at this story from a way where you only see this wound-up clock mechanism. It's more indication of something rather than the original itself. And that's the thing that I problem is that, or the problem that I have is with Wes Anderson increasingly seeming like he only references Wes Anderson instead of any idea feeling new or original. It's like that same thing, but this time with Nazis.
Did it feel new and original to you guys?
Oh, completely. Yeah, and I also think that that his world expanded in this movie. I mean, he's taking on this world historical catastrophe, and that's totally new for his work. Likewise, I thought Moonrise Kingdom, which is also one of my absolute favorites of his, had more to say about love and romance, obviously, than you think, Dana, but also than any of his previous movies, like, in my opinion.
Like, I think this Moonrise Kingdom had some nice things to say about growing up, but when it came to exactly what Chris is talking about, like, actually, I know he's not a psychologist. That's not his thing, right? But still, he is writing characters about people who experience real things that we experience, falling in love, going to war, losing someone, and I don't feel like he's able to connect with those emotions in some way.
Like, this movie to me feels like a sequence in Royal Tenenbaums where somebody was reading a story and we saw the story that they were reading. So it feels like something within one of the wider worlds. He's so much himself, it's impossible not to compare him to his earlier works, which is something that you can maybe talk about. And I have a good quote about that I want to pull out later. But it's a thing where, like, in Rushmore, the stylization of the world, the precision of it, the way it's constructed with all those same things, the very perpendicular tracking shots, you know, the whip pans, the slow motion stuff, it works so well because it's how Max Fisher views himself, and that's the way that he conceives of the world. So we're seeing this world through his eyes, and so the stylistic elements fit the narrative in a complementary way.
Might you not say that about Monsieur Gustave?
Where this is, and in fact, it's explicit in this movie that you're seeing it through the eyes of a character who, you know, cares about all of these small touches in hotels and ornate little pastries.
I mean, I'll buy to a certain extent that the way that it's narratively, like, played hot potato through the narrative lenses that we're seeing this thing, and that it is about a guy who is very dandy, and this is very, like, a dandy perspective of the world, but to me it just felt like an elaborate, you know, crystalline structure that's just like suspending this little piece of paper inside of it instead of the world existing to support the stylistic structure. It's the structure supporting the story instead of the story supporting the structure.
Well, I guess what I want to ask Wes Anderson or anyone who is, you know, making a wholehearted defense of this movie is, if it's true that he's thematizing this himself, he's growing as an artist, like, let's allow that, and that Monsieur Gustave is a figure for him, and that he's precisely making something about how creating a crystalline clockwork universe is, you know, this way of clinging to something good in the world as evil closes in on you, then what is his relation to what's outside of that world? You know, I just feel like at the moment that that comes, that Jeff Goldblum's fingers get chopped off by a door and he's horribly murdered, right? Like, or to get into the spoiler at the end, that Monsieur Gustave himself, off screen and only related to us in a voiceover narration, is shot by the pseudo-Nazis, right? And Agatha, the beautiful Saoirse Ronan character, who's this pure-hearted pastry chef, dies of typhus or something horrible, right? So when these things happen, what is his relation to them, and what relation is he trying to create in the viewer?
Like, there's no tension between the content.
I don't feel that true sorrow. I don't feel
tension.
That sorrow and that suffering really intruding on Monsieur Gustave / Wes Anderson's world.
I mean, I think the point is that if we're going with the idea that it's this crystalline structure, that we're supposed to see the cracks. And basically, I think what this movie is it's about all of these small details and how lovely they can be and how ridiculous and how ridiculous they can be up against these world atrocities, and yet they still can bring some joy, and in fact they can even be a comfort against these things.
But we're supposed
to see Gustav as totally ridiculous, and that's in fact where, like, that tension is where a lot of the humor comes from. There's these hilarious lines, like where he is talking to Zero and he says, "You goddamn fascists, get your hands off my lobby boy," or later when he meets the death squads and he says, "You're the first of the official death squads to which I've been formally introduced. How do you do?" That's a hilarious line that defines that relationship exactly. And I think this movie is very good at that. If you want to say that you can't, like, I do think if we're talking about our larger responsibility towards World War II and the Holocaust and what kind of stories we can or cannot tell.
Well, believe me, I'm not asking him to tell some sort of dreary, hand-wringing story about the
Schindler's
Holocaust.
List.
Right. I don't want him to lose his Wes Anderson-ness or his whimsy. Mr. Gustav is a hilarious character. He's beautifully played by Ralph Fiennes. I mean, this movie is totally full of joys and delights, minute by minute, as you're watching it, you know? I think there's just something about these larger themes that he's grappling with that made me feel like the grappling was happening in some place that wasn't quite on screen for me.
Well, this is partly, I think, where, for me, his style has evolved and grown. But for other people, I'm sure, like you, Chris, and I'm sure others as well, will seem to have shriveled or shrunk, which is that he's increasingly using the stylistic touches that were maybe kind of bracketed in Rushmore have taken over. And to me, what that's doing is the whole movie, it becomes sort of an argument for his art and for art itself. So that, you know, it's not like you see this sort of semi-realistic world within which there are some very Wes Anderson-y touches. It's like the whole world that he's presenting is viewed through this lens. And to me, like I said, it's comparable to the moment in Inglourious Basterds when we suddenly get 70s style, you know, titles over the character and Samuel Jackson's voice comes on and we hear a voiceover. It's all ridiculous, but it's an argument for the movies as movies and for the joy that they provide.
Right. And also, I guess, I mean, now I'm taking Wes Anderson's side and Quentin Tarantino's, I guess, also for saying that we can take on these things, these huge, horrible, unanswerable questions of history from where we are, right? That we don't have to imagine ourselves back into a pre-existing framework. It doesn't have to be Schindler's List. It doesn't have to be something that has been accepted by the culture, that art can continue to deal with those problems. I mean, that seems like a great stance to take to me. I just don't necessarily feel like those two movies, either of them, are quite accomplishing that.
Yeah, and again, I feel like to really portray that, there would have to be any moment in there where the style actually felt at odds with the content, where, like, if he wanted to portray the stylistic elements of this film as you're arguing, Forrest, as metaphorically symbolic of the beauty of the world that Gustav H. inhabited, then I would want to see actually, like, a dark moment where something we saw in this very Fey style, something bad happened, and feel that tension between, like, real bad things happening and the style that he is filming everything in. But everything is like, I mean, the worst that happens is that Jeff Goldblum loses a few fingers, which is very jarring in that movie. But I guess it just doesn't go far enough to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised you felt that way, because it felt to me like this movie has a lot of that. The Goldblum character is maybe the most memorable example just because it's so grotesque, but there's also his cat just before then, and, like, Gustav himself is killed by death squads, and I think
But the cat going out the window is played for
totally
black comic slapstick, the same way the death
shocking.
Of the dog in Moonrise Kingdom, which is something that really stuck in my craw
in, like,
in that movie.
Royal Tenenbaums, he kills a dog at the
true.
End, too. He just likes to kill pets. And I think
Add a
there's
score to
death
Wes Anderson,
all over his movies, and it's always sort of buried below, and I generally don't notice it
but
the more I watch his movies, the more very sad they seem, in addition to being hilarious, which is the number one thing I like them for.
I would make the case that the cat scene is actually played both ways, so that when he throws the cat out the window, it's hilarious.
Is it Adrian Brody who throws him out the window?
Yeah.
No, I think it's Willem Dafoe, right? He's holding this cat that belongs actually to the Jeff Goldblum character, right?
Yeah.
The lawyer. And it's shocking and comes out of nowhere and I think very, very funny. But then you get a shot of the cat on the pavement and there's blood. And it's that is shocking in a different way. It's not you might laugh a little more, but this time with a kind of feeling in the pit of your stomach. Like,
yeah, he's definitely pushing it there on purpose. I'm not saying it's like it's not deliberate, you know, that he's doing the Jeff Goldblum fingers, the shot of the cat. Also, there's more cursing in this movie than there is in your average Wes Anderson movie. And there's a little bit more sex. I mean, mm-hmm. he never really does sex, but there's a little bit of a raunchy, hilarious montage at the beginning of Ralph Fiennes getting it on with all these various countesses around the hotel. All right. Well, we really could sit here and discuss it all day. A bunch of things keep coming into my mind that we haven't brought up yet. But let's go around the table and each just maybe talk about something that really stuck with you, something you did like from the movie. I think we would all agree that anyone who's remotely interested in Wes Anderson should see it, right?
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yes, of course.
And I'll start, actually, because mm-hmm. I wanted to say something about your critique of the whip pans and the lateral, you know, just mm-hmm. the 2D framing and all that stuff that Wes Anderson is so known for, those very flat compositions with things moving across a single plane of the screen. Of course, he does lots of that there. He does a lot of chase sequences that are based around gags having to do with that, people popping in and out of the frame. But there's a couple moments where he plays with that very self-consciously and funnily, too. And I'm thinking of that great slapstick moment when Ralph Fiennes runs from the cops. Remember when Ed Norton, as the head of the, what would you say he's even the head of?
The SS?
He's the head of the secret police, right?
The zigzags in the movie, but it's basically the SS.
The zigzags, right. So
a very sweet, doe-eyed SS commander who's very sympathetic to the main character.
Oh, yeah. Ed Norton is so perfect in that role. I mean, he's one of those actors who can deliver that flat style of Wes Anderson dialogue perfectly. But just visually, there's this great moment where he actually does use depth of screen in a way that seems to be almost commenting, you know, to his detractors that, you know, he never uses the 3D possibilities of the screen. So Ralph Fiennes comes, sees Ed Norton waiting for him, and then there's this kind of very deep focus shot where he goes running off into the far distance. And I love that moment. I loved it as slapstick, and I loved it as camera work as well.
Yeah. And despite my, you know, deep problems and critiques with the tone and story structure of this film, I have to say that it is, as always, overwhelmingly delightful. And there are some really, really awesome sequences in it. I'm specifically thinking of a sequence where Gustav calls on the secret underground society of concierges. That's an extended montage of different people cameoing as concierges of various European continental hotels, which is funny. And then also a downhill winter sports chase sequence, which is also very awesome and
thrilling. Done entirely in miniature animation.
Yeah. And then I just want to, yeah, the one last thing I wanted to say about Wes Anderson in general is this movie reminded me of one of my favorite quotes about art and being an artist, which is Joseph Heller always used to get asked why he never wrote anything as good as Catch-22. And at one point he was quoted as saying, you know, people always ask me why I never wrote anything as good as Catch-22, to which I like to say, who has? And that's like kind of how I think about Wes Anderson. I mean, when you make something that's damn near a perfect film like Rushmore or Royal Tenenbaums, no matter how much I can critique him about folding in endlessly on his own self is pretty perfect. So there could be worse.
Yeah, I agree with that, except my second movie besides Rushmore would be Fantastic Mr. Fox. Mm. All right, Forrest.
Yeah, so like you guys, I think this movie reminded me more than perhaps any other besides maybe Fantastic Mr. Fox that Wes Anderson is just great at writing jokes and pulling off visual gags like the one you described, or the prison sequence is pretty long. It's, I don't know, probably 10 minutes, and it's nearly wordless, and it's just visual gag after visual gag. Some of them are almost Looney Tunes style, and it ends with Gustav just coming up above ground, and he's covered in dirt and everything, and the first thing he says to Zero is just, good evening.
Yeah, this was maybe his funniest movie, I think. It certainly made me laugh harder on a first viewing than anyone save Bottle Rocket, which just cracked me up. But the scene that I would point to, especially since we can spoil things here, is the one that was maybe the funniest, and that's when Willem Dafoe's character, this thug called Joplin, meets his untimely end, which is at the end of that very funny skiing sequence done in miniature, which happens maybe about 25% faster than it should. It has this kind of ridiculous zippy quality to it. And then at the very end, Gustav is facing his own possible death, hanging onto a cliff, and out of, you know, not out of nowhere, but unexpectedly, Zero comes up from behind, and if I caught it correctly, he shoves Joplin off the cliff, and Gustav shouts, "Holy shit!"
Right,
and
this
that
is right after he says, "Me thinks, me breathes, me last."
Yeah, he's always quoting romantic poetry, which is habit that Zero learns from him, and he's quoting some here thinking that he might be doomed, and that then just, you know, shouted expletive kind of rings out through all the prettiness, and everybody in the audience I saw with just broke down laughing.
That's actually an ongoing type of gag in this movie, which is that somebody's burst of flowery language or other sort of courtly behavior is interrupted by some kind of real life mishap, which if you think about it is sort of what, you know, I mean, that's kind of the movie's structure as a whole, right? It's about kind of beauty interrupted. All right. Well, more to be said. Maybe we'll see it again and talk about it again. But thank you all for coming in to talk about the Grand Budapest Hotel with me.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks for having us.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.